Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020, and I'm now here with Tyler, aka Thamster Witnat. So welcome, Tyler. Welcome, Tyler, to Millennial.
Hey, bud. Happy to be here.
Excellent. Let me just get this set up because I've got to share the link around. And there, that's that. And I'm also trying to get entropy working because it hasn't been set up yet. It's a different thing this year. While I do that, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience? To tell them, you know, who you are, where you, your background in this. Because I know some about your background, but not everything. So just take it away.
For sure. So for my background, I came primarily out of an academic background and coming from post-liberal theology, phenomenological philosophy, and embodied cognition. That's where my academic background is, and that ended up becoming the main kind of topics for the shows that we do on YouTube and how we found our way over to this scene. And that's how I made my way over to these views in the first place, was a combination of work in these three areas leading me to certain conclusions that ended up placing me on this side of politics. So it's been a bit of a journey, and overall, what we've been doing on our shows, we have three shows. One's called EBL, the Euro Bureau of Literato. The second's called Interventions, and the third is ECL, is using philosophy and political theory and the like in order to construct a radical alternative to the current world order. But at the same time, we're trying to push beyond certain populist sentiments into a positive program that provides a new view of what human nature is, a new holistic philosophy, and one that is more, I would say, critically anti-modern, but not merely trying to go back. We take a lot of influence from virtue ethics and the like, and as I was saying, a lot of influence from phenomenology. And it's been a bit of a journey, but that is where we mostly come from. I'm also the editor for Radix Journal and the editor for Washington Summit Publishing. So that's mainly what we are involved in and where I come from.
Okay, so that's a nice introduction. I think that some people will be wondering, the sort of obvious question to ask you is, do you come from an NRX background? Take it away.
Actually, surprisingly, no. Before I went to university, I was a Marxist. And then when I went into the theology department, and then the department was made up of mostly radical Orthodox thinkers, post-liberal theologians who were very critical of modernity. And they basically beat the Marxism out of me, to say the least.
And it's surprising that you went to university and stopped being a Marxist.
Well, that's one thing I'm always telling people, is if you want to study philosophy and not get the pause, your best bet's actually a theology department. They're the ones that you will get the most meat out of, and you will be avoiding a lot of the negative effects, especially philosophy departments in the West are just, you know, it's bad, to say the least. But yeah, so it was mainly the theology departments that got me where I was today. And I came to adopt a view that George Grant put forth, a great Canadian philosopher, which is that liberalism and Marxism are both, at the end of the day, sharing the same fundamental ontology and a similar goal, and that is the domination of human and non-human nature by technology. So I came to see this more as the more accurate field of struggle over against class warfare, the kind of great homogenization of the world. And so this is how I moved my way away from Marxism and eventually towards here. And part of that came from, again, post-liberal theology, but it came from reading the great phenomenologists like Husserl, Heidegger, Merleau-Ponty. And that's where I kind of find my ideological and philosophical niches within this broader tradition, so to speak.
Okay. One thing I think people might want to know is what is phenomenology? In your own words.
All right. So a basic general way to put it is it's a method of philosophy that was inaugurated by Edmund Husserl, partly as a response to psychologism, which was a way of understanding logic and mathematics by looking at psychological laws and then saying, okay, if we can understand the brain, we can understand math and logic. Now, Husserl was a mathematician and he was against this, but unlike Frege, the other great 20th century philosopher who founded analytic philosophy, Edmund Husserl, he returned basically to consciousness, and he tried to he did a method which was called eidetic reduction, which meant that you cut off your common sense understanding of the world, and then you let phenomena as it actually is, and then you examine that, and rather, instead of having a reductionist, purely scientific account, or say a dualist account, like a spiritual or soul one, you look at the kind of experience that something is, and its origin in the world of appearance, and the way in which the body interacts with the environment, and intersubjectivity, and all these things combined, and what it makes an experience, what that experience is. So this is the basics of phenomenology. It's describing conscious experiences as it appears to consciousness, and then being able to delineate what kind of experience something is, and which it ends up going quite a bit further than that, though. Because once you start doing this practice, you discover the temporal basis of consciousness, you discover the role of the embodiment in perception, the role of kinesthesia and the like, and the way in which we look at the world as action-oriented rather than theoretical, right? So this is where, to take an example the audience might be familiar with, like with Heidegger's case, for example, he doesn't look at the world as a subject over against an object, and you make a theoretical evaluation of the world, and you calculate everything you do, like turning a knob on a door. Instead, the world is ready to hand, it's present to you, you have a natural familiarity with it, right? And so it starts from this, and then it grows into something more, and you can take this kind of insights into domains like philosophy of religion, but you can also take it into domains like cognitive science with a movement called embodied cognition, which is kind of the third wheel of tradition I come from, and that's to refute the computational view of the mind and representationalist views of the mind, and instead talk about the mind literally in a strong sense as the conglomeration of basically autonomous relational networks. So that would be the brain, the body, the environment, the way you're embedded in it, and then the community of minds, and all these things together make up what we call mind, and that the change in each one is going to affect the change in another. So in this sense, it's neither class reductionist, like in Marxism, it's not, overly obsessed with neural activity, like in computational views. It's a certain view that takes account the way in which minds form by all these contributing factors, which we call embodied, embedded, extended, and inactive. Inactive being for the action-oriented perception. So it's these combinations that makes the philosophical paradigm, which we call embodied cognition. And it's used in the hard sciences now, and there's a bit of a debate between them and the more computational approach. But this does, of course, spill into politics, right? Which is, where we're getting here from. Because we're talking about accounts of human nature. We're talking about, transhumanism, critiques of transhumanism. We're talking about questions of race and culture, and how these things combine to make a view of what we call mind rather than just merely an account of starting from some base, like, some kind of foundation, like it's just genetics or it's just culture or it's just ideas. Instead, it's these things together and something very real.
Could I intervene and ask about an example? I don't know if this is an example of what you're saying or no, you tell me. It seems to me that one of the things, that there's a lot, there are many examples now of where we are expected to go along with something that is counter to our experience and our perceptions. We're expected to go along with lies. And this is a big thing about political correctness, that it's a system of lies. But one of those is that we're told that race isn't a scientific reality. It's not a there's no biological basis for race. But the human perception is that, of course, race exists, and of course, these different groups are there. And so race exists just on that basis alone. It's something that is a, what would you call that, a perceptual phenomenon? I'm not sure how you would say that, but just the fact that we perceive it alone means that it has a reality and that it's relevant, even if it didn't have biological basis, which obviously it does, because otherwise it wouldn't be there in the world and we wouldn't perceive it. But even if it didn't, the fact that we perceive it means, it's relevant to our place in how we see ourselves in the world, and therefore it can't just be discounted or dismissed, and therefore we can't we shouldn't just be told to dismiss it and forget about it, because it is a reality. Would you say that this relates to phenomenology?
Well, it definitely does, for sure. I mean, we would talk about it probably two ways, right? Because if we're talking about the biological body, the role of the body, the role of action-oriented perception coming from the body, then we would definitely look to the genetic basis of race, and we would say that is one of those networks that makes up a kind of mind and a community of minds. And then the other side of that, you would say on the intersubjective side, right, would be this cultural formation, this buildup over time of how groups and ethnic groups come to see themselves and how they come to interact with other ones and define themselves against other ones, and how that very lived experience of, you know, where they come from, where the evolution for them took place thousands of years. And it goes into, you know, how, for example, I just edited Ed Dutton's new book, Making Sense of Race, and he talks a lot about he talks about the different body types that come from these climates that all these races developed in, right? And so that's one way of looking at it, but we can take it a step further in the sense that one of the insights from phenomenology is that the way we approach the world is largely bodily and embodied. So that way in which the body is shaped and in which it comes to form and take on the form it does actually plays a strong role in perception. So it's bodily oriented, but you also have the intersubjective component, which is the community of minds that makes up your kind of experience of the world through language, right? It's knowledge is passed down tradition to tradition, generation to generation. You can't start at square zero, right? It's like saying if you had no language or you're on a desert island by yourself, raised with nobody, you would have essentially no history. Right, because you wouldn't have that community of minds that integrates you. You might have some of the bodily components, but when you mix these two things together, you get the kind of experience in the world that you have.
Well, yes, and I often wonder if that if that's part of globalism to make us this blank slate. As the, I mean, is that another thing that comes up in your work?
Quite heavily, actually. I've been. There's like, let me give an example. So there's two ways to say critique transhumanism. One is from the philosophical.
Could you define transhumanism just for the sake of it? Because when I think of transhumanism, I think of bionic implants and so on. Too. But you probably mean something quite different. So could you define that?
Well, I mean, I think that's very much a part of it. So they'll talk about things like uploading the brain, the consciousness onto a computer and living indefinitely and these kinds of things. It's overcoming limitations. So this goes back to basically creating the new man. And so this goes back to the point I made at the beginning about George Grant's definition of both liberalism and Marxism as a way to dominate human and non-human nature. So it's essentially trying to, in a weird way, and you know, liberalism does this too, with the idea that you have these will and you have negative freedom and you can create and choose the kind of identity you want. It takes on a very Gnostic dimension. What I mean by this is it takes on the dimension that the spiritual world, the world of the mental, is where truth resides, that you're going to create this and live in this kind of reality, and that the bodily world that you inherit, these physical limitations, is something that's naturally degraded and wrong, and you don't rely on these kinds of instincts. And so in a weird way, the liberal move of choosing your own identity just goes perfectly with the transhumanist move of trying to have a flight from the body. And so there could be two general ways to critique that. The first, again, from a phenomenological perspective, is going to look to, say, the idea of temporality, right? The way in which consciousness is quite literally temporality in the sense of what Husserl would call internal time consciousness, which I know this might get a bit complicated.
Well, just before you go into that, I want to intervene and bring it to something that people will recognize, because what you just said there reminded me of Sargon and that group of people that we used to call the skeptic community, now the classical liberal community, as they're calling themselves, and their idea that things, we can be what we choose to be. It's a matter of subscribing to values. And so if you adopt certain values, then you are the thing that is associated with those values. And I have always instinctively felt that there's something very wrong about that, very it's the sort of anemic view of human nature. So that might be relevant to what you were saying there about that this, I forgot what it was you said that reminded me of Sargon. But anyway, sorry, take it away.
Well, I'll just quickly add to that. I mean, that's certainly a part of it. Like, one of the great things you learn from reading someone like St. Augustine in his famous Confessions, which I guess is the first autobiography, he kind of talks about the way in which you have these different wills and they're pulled in all different kinds of directions. Of course, he identifies that with sin, right? But in his view, all these things are moving away from God and the created order and towards nihilism and nothingness. So good, in his view, is quite literally just the absence of evil. Evil's not a thing. So to tie that into what you're saying, it's in an Augustinian view, and I guess in the phenomenological view, is that when you're trying to move away from human nature or towards the created good or towards the way in which the body is developed with in order to kind of have the kind of perception it has to thrive and to live the way it developed, you are moving towards a kind of negation of who you are and to something that's going to be very unhealthy, right? You're having these wills pulled in different directions. And you, I would say that, you know, any kind of passion, anything you could take up can be something good, but it matters about what the will that is behind it. And so a lot of these things, like, if you talk to a liberal, they might talk about some kind of hedonistic, any kind of sexual identity you want, these kinds of things. You know, we're not going to say, okay, well, sexual order in its proper place is bad. We're going to say the way in which it's being used towards negative freedom without regard for how it affects the greater community, how it affects yourself and the way you were developed and the way in which you actually thrive from these kinds of instincts. It's going to lead into a state of negation and nihilism and degradation. So to tie that back into the transhumanism thing, and I'll ignore the time consciousness thing for now, but in a way, if you move past the question of is, say, the singularity uploading your consciousness onto a computer possible, I don't think it is, but I'll ignore that for now. The very act of trying to do it or trying to carry it out or living in a certain way with these kinds of aspirations is going to have negative effects on human nature regardless. So let me take it down to a very easy level and just think of, for example, everyone being in quarantine because of COVID. How you're living. You're living very sedentary, right? You're living a life that you are not meant to live. You're not meant to be sitting around all the time. You're meant to be active. You're meant to be out in the world. Yeah. And so,
even me.
Yeah, and that's a very real example of trying to overcome human limitations and trying to think that we can have a leisurely, plugged in, living in the abstract technological lifestyle, which just does not bode well, right? And so this goes into trying to construct an alternate account of human nature, which I think something like the dissident right is uniquely in the position to offer, because it's the only place where you can have that kind of different view that's not going to be choose your own, right, and ignore bodily reality because you think some mental spiritual world that you made up. Now, I don't mean religious. I mean a Gnostic flight from the body, you can pick your own identity thing, is healthy when it's not.
Right, sorry, I didn't think you were about to stop speaking. So I didn't have something stored up. Sorry, I thought you were in the middle of speaking there. The flight from the body, that was what reminded me of Sargon, because I think that there is this whole, and, you know, obviously Sargon is not the be-all and end-all, but it is, he represents a stream of thinking. And I think it is one that it causes us a lot of problems because it's very predominant in society, this idea, and you get it with the boomers, you get it with us, as millennials as well, and I'm guessing it's even worse in the Zoomer generation, this idea that we are what we decide to be, and the body doesn't really matter, and, you know, physicality. Now, the left have a treatment of history, which is interesting, which the centrist doesn't have. The centrist doesn't seem to have an awareness of, well, things matter. You know, you cannot expect a black guy in America to be entirely unaware of Jim Crow, slavery, the state of Africa. He's probably never been to Africa. It doesn't matter. he is going to feel that he's in a society that wasn't built for him or built by his kind, because that's the truth. And I mean, I'm even, and this is going to annoy some people, I'm even open to the idea of, what's the term, like intergenerational trauma. I'm not saying it's real. I'm just saying I can understand the concept that this is something that comes from the left, identity politics and so on. I can understand it in the same way that I have an awareness of the British Empire and I have an awareness of the British Army and the Blitz spirit. I was never there to see any of these things, but they were passed down to me. They arrived in my life and in my consciousness through history and through, you know, my people. And I'm aware of them, and and they also affect society as well. So then I see that, you know, I see the architecture of the British Empire, etc. And so that's my world. Obviously, there's more to my world than that, but especially nowadays, post 2020. But that's something, and so I can understand why a black guy in America or a black guy in Britain would feel that he didn't belong here. That it wasn't for him. Now, the centrist side response to that is, well, he does belong here, because if he subscribes to these values, then that's that. It's like a membership club. Do you sign on the dotted line? You do? Well, then you belong here as much as anyone else. And I just feel that it's just completely, it's like colorblind. It's like, yeah, you see the structure, but you don't see the shades, the colors, and so on.
Well, I mean, I certainly agree. And I also think that you could take what you said a bit further about intergenerational trauma and talk about, say, the experience of being European in North America. Because for us, like at a very young age, you're basically taught that your being here is illegitimate, it's founded on an evil, violent act, and that you are essentially supposed to remove yourself from a position of influence and power, even if you don't actually have it. And so it leads to this feeling of homelessness generally around, you know, young whites growing up in North America. And they don't have a sense of identity or who they are, where they come from. There's like vague remnants of it. There's memories of it. There's things that will reawaken the soul in a certain sense, but you have to go outside the norm to find it. And it leads to this sense of crisis of identity or who you are or where you come from. And then what comes with that, of course, is the loss of the sense of duty or who you should be or how you should behave as a man and a European, and this sense of common good and community that you have with others. And so on the one hand, you're told that the existence is illegitimate and it's founded on an evil, violent act. And on the other hand, that you have to just choose to be whichever you want. And so it's a bit of a possibly the worst possible combination you could have, because you're removing someone's history and then saying start from the ground up, and you don't have.
But also be ashamed of your history.
Exactly. Exactly. And then you don't have role models, and, you know, the last generation are kind of famous for not passing on very much to the next one, right? And you combine these things, and you combine the sense of media pressure and scapegoating. And it's in a weird way, it's almost like kind of like what Rene Girard would talk about, the sacrificial object that is kind of what binds a community together by sacrificing something, right? And this is what basically pays the toll and for the violence that's ensued by community and by political coercion. And in the Americas, it seems like white supremacy and whites by extension is basically this ideology that's offered as the sacrificial goat, right? So they play the role. Everyone pays lip service to it. And then, you know, the neoliberal masters, American financial empire could go on to do all the horrendous things it does. And we could have the worst sense of elites, and it could destroy lives, destroy communities at home, all over abroad. And then no one really gets to say much about it, because they put the blame on whites as a way to deflect that, right? This is partly why we look at the left now, they've moved from labor and class and things like this towards this, you know, as you were talking about with your guests earlier, protesting whenever there's some kind of nationalist thing, but they're not going to say anything about small businesses closed. And so this is that sacrificial lamb that lets them, in a way, participate in the ongoing ideological gloss of power legitimization that elites are going to rely on in order to withhold and push back any kind of genuine resistance to it. So it takes resistance. And this was the move that happened, of course, in the 60s. And this was a problem with the new left, was that it took resistance and it moved it to that identity level. and to the level of, okay, well, if we give you a piece of the pie, you could just become one of the managerial elites, right? Rather than actually questioning the functioning of the system as a whole. And so at the worst part of this is that whites end up being the scapegoat for a neoliberal financial empire that is killing them first and then around the world killing a lot of others.
Yes, and ultimately it's also not good for the minorities because they're also going to get merged together and just turned into consumers with no identity either. I think they might be used as a cudgel to beat whites with in the meantime, psychologically, but in the long term, they're for the chop as well. Because, I mean, the system has to. Well, I mean, what would you say? That's another thing altogether. Before we get to the present day, let me ask you another question about something you said earlier. Liberalism versus Marxism. How would you define, what would you say those have in common, those two systems of thought? What would you say are the commonalities and the differences between them, the contradictions?
Well, I think the commonality between them is the same modern heritage. And in a sense, Marxism does derive a lot of influence from the Scottish Enlightenment, but also derives a lot of influence from Hegel and inverts him in certain ways. But I think the main shared similarity between the view is this kind of economic view or material view of man. So you talk to your average conservative, like in the Republican Party, they'll say, okay, if people can afford all these nice TVs, regardless of what kind of social circumstance or spiritual crisis that they're in, because at base, I think this is a spiritual crisis, is they can nonetheless be happy, right? We can look at material determinations and say that, okay, we have a good people, they have their needs are being met, they could live, they can choose to live X, Y, Z way. And on the Marxism side, you kind of have the same thing. You have the malleability of man and how man seems himself is determined on the basis of material conditions. Now, I know some more Marxist friendlies in the chat might be like, okay, well, Marx didn't really believe that. He said some things about race. Well, this arises in Marxism because Marx kind of left undetermined the actual relation of race and freedom and the like and these kind of other parts about human nature. He left it very, very under-theorized, aside from paying some other notes to it, while he focused on the material conditions. So when you get to Lenin and the Russian Revolution, the like, Lenin actually upplayed the so-called scientific aspect. And that's kind of where you get this malleable view of Marxism from. It's that was inherent in Marxism. It was a bit of a seed because the theory lends itself to this. And so that, to me, the shared instance between them goes back to trying to perfect a new man or a new mode of human nature by meeting needs. And once you've met these needs, you can have the most efficient run society, right? And so the same thing with a lot of free market ideologies. And you could trace this from German ordo-liberalism, for example, some of the French new liberalism of the 70s, and then the Chicago school neoliberalism, basically, what Foucault calls the creation of the sites of veridiction, which is a combination between verification and truth. So basically, by allowing the market as something natural, as some aspect of human nature that's going to produce the best results, if you open up every formerly public institution or any area of protected social life to the forces of the market, you'll get the ideal circumstances for man, basically. And so at the bottom, they both share that material view of man, which I think is just false. And I think they're both part of a certain modern way of looking at the world, which I would say, as someone coming from a tradition in post-liberal theology, we might say, okay, this was just a path that was taken and has its roots in certain medieval heresy, but it is not necessary. There's no progressive view of up to down, like in Whig history, like we're getting better and better because of this technology and because of this worldview. There's no progressive view of history. And so that's where we would make it as something contingent, right? As something not necessary. This is the path that was taken. It doesn't have to be this way. And we could and should choose something else.
Yeah. What you said about when material needs are met, we will have the most efficient society. That's a theory that you were quoting. Again, I've talked to people, and again, mostly boomers, who, and I'm not making a slight, I'm just saying, you know, in my experience, although I'm certain that it's a very widespread feeling among my own generation as well, who will say that, well, what do people need? they need a job. They need job prospects. And if they've got job prospects, that's it. You know, everyone. This, and again, this is so. I mean, I'll be talking about this with Luke Smith in a few nights' time. But this is such an interesting. It's a view of human nature that I think could only have been possible in the second half of the 20th century, because you know there was economic prosperity, more or less, not all the time, not constant, but more or less the average line was upwards economically. And I don't think it could have existed any time before that. And I also think that it's now becoming obsolete. I think it's now becoming untenable. And we're going to have a new economic system. And I think this is what's signaled by the Great Reset. It's a new economic system that will, in some sense, take care of people's material needs. But it will be even worse for them than capitalism, because they won't even have self-actualization that they would have got by having their own business, by having, you know, joining a big company or whatever, being self-employed. They won't have that. They'll all be on UBI. Now, their material needs might be met, but it's even more spiritually unnourishing than the than capitalism was, or, you know, post-industrial capitalism was. And so I think this is it is something that is becoming ever more relevant, I think. Do you have anything to say about that?
Actually, two things. I'll start with the first half, what you said, and the second half. They're both really important points. And one thing I want to say is what we're describing here is this view of human nature and this view of politics is basically what I think produces the most dangerous kind and most incompetent kind of political elites. And that's the idea that you're essentially taking on a managerial role to manage or to maximize efficiency in some kind of institution or some kind of market or something of the like. And of course, it's lied about. It's basically said, okay, we're employing people, putting the government, putting them in positions of managers and the like because of competence. But what that actually usually means in practice is a bit of competence, a bit of know-how, a bit of networking, a bit of money, a bit of family nepotism and things like this. But what the problem this produces is this huge gap between people and then the elites. And I mean this in the sense that we don't trust them anymore. We have no reason to trust them because...
Well, I mean, look at Bill Gates and the Amazon guy and the Apple Mac guy. Yes, I don't trust them.
Right. And part of the reason is because when they are occupying a certain role, it's because of certain kind of affluence, right? In other words, they're occupying the role like they're celebrities because of who they are, basically. And this is very different from how political authority, social authority, cultural authority, and community authority was exercised in the past. Namely, that when you entered a role, say as a policeman or a military man or a priest or some kind of involvement in your local community. This, by the way, is why TikTok videos of soldiers twerking and that is so offensive on a base level, is because when you entered into these areas of authority, you weren't there for yourself. You were there as basically some sort of embodiment of the symbolic role that those political authorities were meant to do. In other words, it was a mission. If the symbol that you put on your uniform, those roles mattered more than the person occupying them. So the person occupying them is supposed to take on a burden. It's supposed to be a responsibility. It's like Christ saying, you have to be the lowest. You have to put yourself and you have to serve. So in this sense, the lower the leader is one who is supposed to serve and occupy as this part of an institution that's bigger than themselves, and they're playing a role that's going to last regardless of them there or not. It's not about them. But now it's looking to people. Now it's looking into lies about competence and the like. And so you have no sense of initiation or ritual involved in participating in one of these institutions. You don't enter and say, okay, now I'm going to carry out this mission, say I'm in the CBC, and that's giving reliable literary media to the people, which is what CBC existed for in the first place. It was actually a conservative operation. But you don't go into these things with that mindset that it's something bigger than you. So you get basically these kinds of games between elites and these power games and these kinds of putting above very vain pursuits and basically managerial roles that goes into them. So there's no sense of accountability or responsibility. It's all about managerial roles. And this is where I think you get the birth of populism, basically. And I know that's an ill-defined term, but it's this mass distrust. And this is where you get a lot of certain conspiracy theories and the like, some of which are grounded in reality. But they exist for a good reason, because you have no reason to trust them. And then this moves into the second point, which you brought up, which I think is very important. And this is on, for example, the issue of UBI and things like this. And this is where I'm very critical, and us on the show are very critical of populism in general. It's a way it kind of puts you at the mercy of a different political movement, or basically makes you being used for the interests of elites of another. And so if you look at something like UBI or student debt forgiveness or ending forever wars or things like this, or returning jobs from overseas, all these are good things, right? We do want these. We do want people help. We don't want to be in forever wars. I agree student loan debt should be erased. But the problem comes is when you base a movement around these kind of populist impulses, in the neoliberal system, in the American financial empire, theoretically, they could give you all these things. And nothing fundamentally is going to change. It's going to be, yeah, it will help you. It's good. In fact, people that are distant, if you had UBI, you wouldn't be so scared of the financial aspect, right, of putting this up, assuming it's actually true universal basic income. But when you give these things to them and it becomes possible, then you don't challenge a system. You're constrained by realist political analysis. You're saying, okay, well, in the short term, these things are good. Realistically, these things are good, but I think we need to be idealistic in the sense that we need to have a sense of vision and a radically different answer, which I don't think is we've quite come up with yet. But if you just play these realist games, then you get stuck in someone else's paradigms, because theoretically they could solve it. And so then the great question, this comes to worse forms of populism too, like a lot of the mega forms of populism, where it's kind of predicated on getting behind Trump and trying to be a conservative and appeal to people on this level. And this was the problem with, which, of course, I was in full support of that in 2016, but I think that there's limitations. And it goes back to Patrick Buchanan. It goes back to the moral majority, is we always get involved in these populist sentiments, and it ends up being used by power because it's a way of wielding strength from one set of elites against another. And so you end up being a pawn in that game. So the question I always pose when people play these kind of populist games or suggest it as a solution is, what do you do when you get that power? What do you do when you get what you want? That is the scariest thing. As you look at Alex Jones types and them, it's what do you do when you get what you want? And they can't envision that, because you need that constant pushback from the elites in order for that kind of populist rhetoric and that kind of money to come in. Because if you were given what you want, then that vision that you need to create something new that's challenging to the system is going to be shown as empty, basically. And that's not what we want. And so we need to think about what we would do with power. What kind of world would we actually want to build?
Yeah, and that is a very, very important, that whole area is crucial. Because I think that the right, by which I don't even mean the right, really, I just mean us and whatever we are, the right has got so accustomed to not having power that I think we don't even think about gaining power, or how to gain power, or what power is, or what we would do with it if we had it. What we've got accustomed to doing instead is just moaning about, well, why don't those in power give us what we're asking for? And maybe we can sway them to do that. But we don't think, well, power is actually imminent in the world and has to be acquired. That's a big fucking job. I mean, we thought 2016, that's it. It's somehow happened by fluke, by luck. Power has fallen into our hands, but it hadn't at all. First, because Trump was, you know, a cuck. And second, because the entire machine around him was basically unchanged. It was, and was able to thwart him at every turn. So you get your guy in, but it's as good as irrelevant. You know, you might as well have had Barack Obama in the White House I don't want to be a black pillar here. I'm just saying, in some ways, it might even have been better if Barack Obama had been in there for the last 4 years, because we wouldn't have had all the shit that we've had to deal with.
Yeah, well, it's been a pressure release valve, basically, for the right, as you get Trump in there, and then it allows you to play these games of, okay, well, it would be worse for censorship or the like if we had someone else. But when you actually examine what goes on, that's just not really the case. And so it ends up being very blinding in a way, and it ends up taking any kind of thought that we would need to put into to create an action that would actually be helpful. And it ends up just putting it into some other kind of program, right? Which is what we were getting at before. And I think a big part of the thing is that there's this refusal to get past the fact that we're not Republicans, and it's not naturally on our side either. Because you get in a situation where you think about it. I mean, what do they want? It's economic liberalization plus global citizenship within the empire. It's not in any way our thing, right? And it's this weird, mystifying problem that's been going back since the 80s with the moral majority, back before that, whenever we give energy to these kinds of thinking and these kinds of people. And so I think part of what we try to do on the show, aside from get people interested in philosophy, right, because we all talk to them about Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, them, is to actually use the way in which they talked about wider scale political questions in a way that postmodern philosophy doesn't do. It just focuses more on minute criticism, which is good in some levels, but it's not very sprawling. And actually be able to come up with alternatives in every kind of area of institution, right? So I'm always like saying, if you come from a background in education, try to write and put forth what education would look like in our model. If you come from healthcare, try to do it from there. If you're coming from employment, try to do it from there. All I'm saying is, it's not saying you're going to get power overnight just because you give an alternative. But what needs to be said is that the far left doesn't have any alternatives. You watch videos of Alain Badiou, Slavoj Žižek, and them. They're all saying, where do we go from here, right? No one really has the answers other than liberal hegemony, has hegemony. And I think that this is something crucial that we could fill that void if we're willing to roll up the sleeves and do the work and take step one.
Well, I mean, if we don't, then other people will. I mean, that's a crucial thing here. We can just sit back. We do have that option, but the result of it will be that other people take control and just do what they want. I think you're right that leftism as such is at an impasse and is largely impotent at this point. What we're seeing is it uses leftism, it uses the left, but it also warps them. I mean, it warps Antifa to fight for global corporations. That's just one example. What we have, I guess, is what would you describe that? I mean, would you say just neoliberalism? What would you describe it as?
That's usually what I go with, neoliberalism, or you could say American financial empire. I usually just go with neoliberalism because the program is basically the same. It's this gradual marketization of things that are essential parts of community that formerly weren't. And this was kind of a process that began in the 70s. And it's just been a gradual process on and on and on and on. And it certainly is in crisis now, but I would still put it as neoliberal.
Yeah. And you said earlier that when I said that, I quoted the sort of archetypical boomer saying that what people need is jobs and financial security and their material needs met. What would you say that people need? Because, you know, several times you've alluded to that being an anemic view of human nature. What would you say? Because you said it was a spiritual crisis that we're dealing with here. I mean, you can say, you know, whether it's liberalism or Marxism, these are materialist views of human nature. What are they missing? What is it that people need?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, but I would say, first, what do people need? God, the good, basically, participation in that. But that extends, of course, to all facets of culture and people and ethnos. And what I mean here is that there's a notion of common good, that what is ethical is by you have something duty to another person, right? You have duty from, as Aristotle would break it down in the Politics, from male to female to family, and then from there to tribe and then community, and then upwards and upwards and so forth until you get the political community. And I think that this is something crucial and simple but overlooked, is this idea of virtue ethics. It's this idea of participating in a common good bigger than yourself, and you're part of a people, and there's a sense of mission there. And so what I mean by this is that ideally, this would be something like, and this is where I'm a little critical of third positionism, even though I consider myself one, is where you would have something more than just the state that looks after the people, right? You would have instead intermediary institutions. And what I mean by this is institutions of participation at the smaller local level that's kind of in between institutions of the state. And so they would be relatively independent, but they would still be public. And so what I mean by this is like cultural institutions, right? Parts of community where families and their can get involved in, kids are raised in, they're raised in a certain way of what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what it means to have relations with each other and to promote the common good. And so I think ultimately it goes back to God, but I think from there, all of it goes upward towards it in a sense of your duty to your family and to others in your community, and then a sense of how we come to live together. And so I think the main distinction between what I think and what the neoliberal order think is I simply don't put the material as the highest. I think if you don't have that community, you don't have a sense of identity, you don't have a sense of belongingness, basically, and a sense of duty. In fact, I think we should just discard the notion of human rights entirely. Just get rid of that. And if you focus on these kinds of things, I can speak more on the human rights thing in a sec, but if you focus on these kinds of things, you would have a lot more healthier society, basically. You would have healthier people. You would have healthier families. I just don't think that this kind of choose your own thing, everything's marketable, everything's consumable, everything's homogenous, is going to make people happy in the long run, and it's definitely not. And I think everyone here is familiar with suicide rates and things like this.
Well, it's not going to make people happy, but also it's just not a good enough alternative to what's going on now. It's just not comprehensive enough, I don't think. I mean, to say, well, let's just make everyone happy, what does that even mean? And as you said earlier, the corporations already have a solution for that, to make everyone happy, just give them endless sensations. Yeah, sorry, do you have something to say about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, see, one of the problems is, I mean, this is another Augustinian point. Maybe the Catholics here might be happy about this, no pun intended, but happiness, in a way, as something that you can, the political order and media can claim to give to you, is one of the worst possible things, because pure happiness isn't simply possible, right? And I think this is one of the problems with the fact that we live a very abstracted and isolated community life, is when you see suffering of those in your community and brokenness and broken homes and this disattachment from those you should care about, like you should care about your neighbors, you should care about your kids' kids, you should care about what kind of culture they're going to have and that kind of experience they're going to have, right? If you focus on happiness all the time, you're going to, like the Stoics, try to push away all these natural consequences of the choices you make. Like if you're a parent and you're a single mom, for example, and so you start dating XYZ guy and constantly bring them around your kids, and then you're like, well, it's my choice and you can't tell me what to do. But you are playing this idea that you should be happy, and you're not aware of the suffering that comes with life and the duty that you have to be the best version you can be. And that requires a strict right or wrong. That means you don't have choices, and then that's it. Instead, all choices require some sense of burden, some sense of responsibility. And you could only take that if you understand the fact that you're not going to get everything you want. Things have consequences. Happiness is completely unattainable. You could be healthy. You could have virtue. You could have happiness in the Aristotelian sense of moderation and excellence and becoming something, becoming a better man, becoming a better woman, becoming a better role model, being physically healthy, being mentally healthy, things we should all aspire to. But if we ignore the suffering part of life and that we the duty we owe to those as a part of a community, which is what unfortunately is done in the West, right? You can't even talk about your problems if you're a white man without being called incel or X, Y, or Z. Then I think you get a very inhuman kind of culture.
Yeah, it's awful. I chuckle because it's true, not because I think it's funny. Okay, so there was a comment earlier that I want to put to you. And this is a sort of, I think, dismissive comment, but I'm curious to hear what you would say in response to it. This guy says, how about we just close the borders, look after the poor, and give childbirth rewards? We don't need philosophy for that. What would you say about that? How about we just close the borders, look after the poor, and give childbirth rewards? What would you say about that?
Well, like, I always find those kinds of comments just strange, because when you're saying you should look after the poor, you should do X, Y, Z, you should just close the borders, all the questions you're going to get asked is why. And all those things are philosophical questions, quite frankly. I mean, if you look around and neoliberal hegemony right now, the reasons they have open borders and all these things is, yes, there's a motive for power there, but it has a long history in philosophy. Like, these things came from somewhere. This wasn't natural. This didn't just appear in the last month or two or the last year, right? Our elites didn't just act this way for no reason. There are seeds going back to modernity, to nominalism, to these things that led us to where we are. And the fact is, we don't educate the young in a healthy view or in a healthy philosophy. You get the kind of society that you basically by what you love and the sense of what you prioritize, what you think is valuable. And we value negative freedom above everything else. We value profit. We value these kinds of things, right? And that is a philosophical problem. And if you need an answer, if you want an answer, you're going to have to be able to engage in philosophy. I mean, even just practically speaking, right? Like, yeah, you could play the strong man and say, okay, well, if I came into power and these, you know, terrible neuromaniacs were hooking up people's brains and giving them an fMRI eye scan and saying, okay, well, this is the part of the brain where makes you an extremist. And then you can say, okay, well, I'll just take these people and round them up. But the fact is, you don't have hegemony. You have to have an answer for these kinds of questions. You have to understand views of the mind and the brain and consciousness, and you have to understand metaphysics. You have to be able to push back on these things if you want to actually get good people on your side. Now, I'm not saying you're going to have a huge mass movement. Revolutions come from 10% of the population, quite frankly, and it usually requires funding and it requires elites. You can't get around that. But to do that, you need a vision, and it doesn't exist. You can't just, hypothetically, you could close the borders tomorrow and you're still going to have the same kind of soul crushing system and just say, okay, we didn't educate, we didn't change anything, we just said, here's some money to have kids. Well, so what? It's not just about survival. Survival is baseline. You need to have thriving. I want whites to survive, but just also to thrive. You don't just want to live. You're not an animal. You don't want to be preserved and have a right to exist like you live in a fucking zoo. Right.
Yeah. But also, we're not going to close. I mean, you say we could just close the borders tomorrow and give money to the childbirth rewards, but that wouldn't solve the problem. But that won't even happen. Yeah, this is the question. It's all very well for this guy to say, well, why don't we just do these things? Well, why aren't we just doing those things? Yeah, that's it's pointless to say, well, this is what we, well, of course, that's what we should do. We all know that's what should be done. The question is, why is it not already being done? And that is a legitimate question. The point is, it's easy to scoff at philosophy. It's easy to say, well, this is all highfalutin, pretentious, LARPing or whatever. But it's, yeah, there's a possibly apocryphal quote from Marx that he said at one point, world communism was nothing but me and Engels sitting in the British Library. Now, yeah. So things grow from small acorns. But the point is that you need to have some kind of solution, some kind of an entire worldview laid out ready, because otherwise you will not get the things, even the things that should be obvious, self-evidently good ideas, because there's already a huge worldview in place to refute those ideas. Otherwise, they would already be happening. The fact that they're not already happening should be evidence to you that we do need to do this philosophizing.
Yeah, and it's also not like I'm saying, because like a common straw man is usually, for people who watch our stuff for the first time, is usually, well, you're just saying do philosophy, then next step you have victory, which is not what I'm saying. I'm saying it's an essential component. Of course, you need other things. You need to get involved in the community. You need to, you need to become healthy. You need to engage in all kinds of political activism, but you need to do it intelligently, and you need a map. When you rush into a situation without thinking about it, like as what's happened with, again, since the moral majority in the time of Reagan or the time of Buchanan and the likes, is the various ways the dissident right has ended up caught up in a lot of these things is because they don't quite push back enough on covering up with something new. They react. And they do it well. But it's, in a sense, it's this kind of populist contrarianism where you just say no to the leads because you don't trust them. And I agree, you shouldn't. But you don't just do the opposite and then try to have a mass movement and say, okay, well, let's just close the borders. Let's do this. you have to be able to push back on the more fundamental level, and that will give you a roadmap. But it'll also tell you that you're going to be able to use philosophy to look for weaknesses in the system. You're going to look for places that a part of human nature and a part of culture that the current system simply can't answer. And it's doing a bad job of doing it because it has a bad view of what how a human flourishes, because what happiness is. And it creates these negative antagonisms. And so we have to be able to intervene on that level and give a better alternative. And then, of course, the very last thing to say on that is, if you ignore the role of philosophy, if you go all the way back hundreds and hundreds of years, the kind of things we have now was planted as seeds all the way back then. And that's just the way it is. You have to engage in this project. And it's a fun project.
All right. Well, I guess that's a good place to end. Can you summarize the three shows that you do on your channel? Because this, you know, seems to lead on from what you've just said.
Yeah. Well, so the first show is kind of the side one. It's just ECL, Euro Cinephile Lounge. And it's just looking at film from a philosophical perspective. Me and my co-host there, Fashi Zizek, are actually working on a series taking a look at Japanese horror cinema and analyzing how cultural expression after cultural trauma and losing the war plays into these kinds of horror films and how they see themselves. And so that will be something coming out soon. The other show, EBL, which is the main show, it was actually a Radix show, but unfortunately we got banned on YouTube. So now the audience is just trying to find this again.
But well, what does EBL stand for?
Euro Bureau of Literato.
Okay.
You can find it on YouTube under Thamster Witnet. And basically that's going from text and philosophy. Right now we're doing ancient to medieval political philosophy. Up next we have St. Thomas Aquinas. And we introduce the text and make it fun for the audience, but we also tie it back to current political events so it feels relevant, right? So it's longer format. We do explain things in detail. So it's a little more niche and a little more complicated, but we do try to make it more accessible. And then the third show is Interventions, which we made to basically whenever some political event or political commentary. So we more focused on events of the day. And that's the most popular one of them all, because it's the most direct and audience friendly.
Excellent. Well, that's the links to that. The relevant links will be in the description for anyone who's interested. So thank you very much. I think this has been a good introduction to you for people. It's been a very interesting discussion. Obviously, there's a huge amount more that we could say, but I want to keep these episodes fairly brief. So any final thoughts just before we close it?
No, it's fun. Thank you for having me. It was really enjoyable. It's good talking to you.
Yeah, it's the first time. We've known of each other for years, but I think this is the first time we've actually spoken, which seems insane.
It is, yeah. At least in terms of not being on messages, at least in terms of voice.
Yeah. Okay, well, excellent. Well, I will be back in an hour with Davis MJ Arini, in a fellow Canadian, and I think he's actually from the same part of Canada as you are. But in the meantime, thank you, Tyler, and I hope this gets you some new subscribers. And thank you for taking part in Millennial 2020.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. I'll see you all later.